A lot of Republicans are looking at it and saying, you know, look how soft they went on him. But that's a, you know, very standard procedure by which prosecutors adhere, offering lighter sentences in exchange for admissions.
And finally, we just have 10 seconds, but the U.S. attorney Trump appointed.
That's right.
Ken Klippenstein, I want to thank you for being with us, investigative border reporter with The Intercept. We'll link to the piece that you co-wrote with Ryan Grimm, What Does the FBI Have on Hunter and Joe Biden? That does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Wernup, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is Bill McKibben coming at you on KBOO, Portland, Oregon.
Our goal is to create an atmosphere devoid of genre, a place where quality is key. It's important for the world and future generations to understand the power of art and music. Ultimately, we are doing our part to carry on tradition. Tune into Passing Sound, the first Saturday of each month at 10 p.m. on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM, or KBOO.FM. Where we make musical structures for the listener to enjoy.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, self-service gas could soon be available to all Oregonians as a bill heads to the governor's desk.
A federal judge permanently blocks Arkansas's ban on gender-affirming health care for minors.
And women reflect on the state of reproductive rights a year after the Dobbs Supreme Court decision.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 21st, 2023. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Laura Miller. Oregonians may soon have the option of pumping their own gas after a self-service bill passed the state Senate today. House Bill 2426 would change Oregon law to require gas stations to allow customers to pump their own gas if they choose. Stations will still retain half of their pumps for attendance, and the bill would require self-service and attended service to be offered at the same price. The bill received bipartisan support, and lawmakers hope it will help alleviate long gas lines and staffing shortages at gas stations. Jeanine Solman, a Democrat from Hillsborough and a chief sponsor of the bill, said, quote, "It provides Oregonians choice at the pump while still protecting access for the elderly and disabled community members," end quote. Lawmakers in opposition have voiced concern about how quickly the bill will go into effect. After passing the Senate, the bill heads to Governor Kotek's desk for her signature. The bill will go into effect immediately after the governor's signature and could signal the eventual elimination of attendant service. Oregon and New Jersey remain the only two states in the U.S. where drivers aren't allowed to pump their own gas.
A federal judge permanently blocks Arkansas's ban on gender-affirming care for minors. It's a big win for LGBTQ advocates across the nation. District Judge James Moody ruled that Arkansas violated the U.S. Constitution with the ban. Arkansas passed a ban on gender-affirming treatment for people under 18 in 2021. It was blocked by a judge back then, and now the judge says that preventing teens from getting treatment, like hormone therapy and delaying care until they're adults, would cause them irreparable harm. Moody's ruling reads, quote, "Rather than protecting children or safeguarding medical ethics, the evidence showed that the prohibited medical care improves the mental health and well-being of patients, and that, by prohibiting it, the state undermined the interests it claims to be advancing," end quote. The American Civil Liberties Union brought the case. They argue that the law limited the free speech rights of doctors by saying they couldn't refer patients for gender-affirming care. The judge agreed. They also argued that the law took away the due process rights of parents who wouldn't be able to make decisions about their children's health care, and that it discriminated against minors based on sex. Other states have passed similar bans, like Alabama, Florida, and Indiana, but they're all temporarily on hold.
A Portland city contractor must pay for items illegally thrown away during a homeless camp sweep in 2020. Last week, an arbitrator ruled in favor of Lynette Snook in her case against Rapid Response BioClean. Snook alleges Rapid Response failed to store dozens of personal possessions, including a mobile shower, a portable toilet, and a propane stove following a November 2020 sweep in St. John's. Rapid Response BioClean is Portland's primary contractor for cleaning and removing homeless campsites. They are required by law to bag, label, and store any personal belongings of value at a warehouse for 30 days, during which time owners can retrieve them. When the Rapid Response team arrived at Snook's camp, Snook and her partner attempted to sort and secure their possessions, but soon noticed many essentials were missing. Snook told the Portland Mercury, quote, "We were so exhausted from the whole thing. Normally, when you're told to move, 72 hours notice or whatever, we were always ready to go. During COVID, we weren't ready for it," end quote. Snook was unsuccessful in retrieving her items, so she got an attorney with the help of volunteer homeless advocates. Their case against Rapid Response successfully proved the company had failed to follow the city's mandatory storage policy. City arbitrator Chris Davis ordered Rapid Response to pay Snook $409 for the lost items. This is not the first time Rapid Response has been documented for failing to follow storage policy. In 2021, a class action lawsuit against the City of Portland filed by unhoused Portlanders cited city contractors, quote, "pattern, practice, and custom of systematically ignoring the requirements of state law, depriving plaintiffs and other similarly situated homeless people of liberty and property without due process," end quote. Tracking devices placed by the plaintiff's attorneys showed confiscated items went straight to landfills. The city settled with the plaintiffs in that case.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is holding a series of open houses in California and Oregon so people can weigh in on whether sea otters should be reintroduced to parts of their historical range. Suzanne Potter has the story.
The public can weigh in on the possibility of reintroducing sea otters to stretches of the California and Oregon coasts at a series of open houses this week and next, hosted by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Historically, a 250,000 sea otters lived along the Pacific Rim, but fur traders hunted them to near extinction. The southern sea otter population in California expanded from a few dozen 100 years ago to about 3,000 now. Lillian Carswell with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says the open house are an opportunity to hear the concerns of community members and stakeholders.
We want to provide an opportunity for people to just talk face-to-face and ask questions and share their perspectives. And all the information that we get will be used to help inform next steps, if any.
Find a meeting near you on the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service website. Right now, sea otters range from Santa Barbara to San Mateo counties, but are hemmed in by white shark populations. In the future, otters could be released in estuaries where they'd be safe from sharks, as has been done in Monterey. Otters are beneficial to their ecosystems, in particular because they reduce the sea urchin population, which has devastated kelp beds, and kelp provides habitat for many species while sequestering carbon. Andrew Johnson is with Defenders of Wildlife in California. He says the nonprofit conservation group is working with stakeholders to figure out what would be necessary for reintroduction and establish the best potential locations.
So the idea is to try to jump over this area where there seems to be poor habitat and a lot of white shark presence, and trying to get them up into areas where they can continue their expansion and repopulation of these historical areas.
Early next year, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is expected to make a decision on whether reintroduction should be part of the management strategy for southern sea otters. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Women in Washington discuss the state of reproductive rights a year after the Dobbs decision, and youth activists call for gun reform. With more on the story, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
For 50 years, there have been despicable and violent attacks on life, many of the worst happening in the last year alone. Who can- Yet we are steadfast in standing up and providing a voice for the voiceless and the most vulnerable, the unborn who cannot speak for themselves.
New York Republican Representative Elise Stefanik looked back over the last year since the U.S. Supreme Court struck down abortion rights across the nation. Since then, 20 states have implemented a range of abortion bans, while in others, courts blocked them pending further litigation. Abortion remains legal in 24 states, some of which enacted new protections. In 2024, Maryland and New York voters will vote on amendments to enshrine reproductive rights in their state constitutions. First Lady Jill Biden says consequences go far beyond a woman's right to choose.
Women are being denied access to medications that treat arthritis and cancer, even when they aren't pregnant. And survivors of rape and incest are being forced to travel across state lines for care.
Meanwhile, youth activists are calling on elected officials in Washington to enact better gun reforms. Education Week's school shooting tracker shows there have been 167 school shootings between 2018 and June 2023. Alea Eastman, a survivor of the school shooting in Parkland, Florida, feels schools shouldn't be war zones.
We can and we must do more to ensure that no one has the fear of joining this club nobody wants to be a part of. I call on those who serve at the will of the people to stand up and join our fight so we can pass sensible solutions. And if not, get out of our way.
Florida governor and Republican presidential candidate Ron DeSantis visited Nevada for a fundraising event in Gardnerville, where progressives say his policies are a step in the wrong direction. Don Echeverry, Nevada State Education Association president, cited Florida's education policies as a sweeping set of restrictions on classroom discussions on race and gender.
When DeSantis calls his effort the parental rights bill, let's just call it what it is, the Don't Say Gay bill. This law is about hate and nothing more. All this bill tends to do is target our LGBTQ+ students who are some of the most vulnerable in our communities and in our schools.
An Arkansas federal judge has struck down the state's law forbidding gender transition treatments for children and teenagers. The case was viewed as a test of whether transition care bans for minors would withstand legal challenges. In this first-in-the-nation ruling, Judge James Moody Jr. said the law discriminated against transgender people and violated the constitutional rights of doctors. He added the state failed to prove several claims, like transition care was experimental or carelessly prescribed to teens. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The U.S. Coast Guard is bringing in new ships and underwater vessels to search for a submersible that disappeared Sunday while bringing 5 people down to the wreck of the Titanic. Underwater noises were detected yesterday by a surveillance aircraft. Search teams heard banging in the region about every 30 minutes. Submarine crews trapped underwater are taught to bang on their submersible's hull to be detected by sonar. The lost submersible could be as deep as 12,500 feet below the surface. Rescuers need to pinpoint the vessel's location, reach it with an appropriate equipment, and bring it to the surface, if it's still intact, all before the passenger's oxygen supply runs out. The area of the North Atlantic where the Titan submersible went missing is prone to fog and stormy conditions, making it an extremely challenging environment in which to conduct a search and rescue mission. The 22-foot carbon fiber vessel was reported missing Sunday night, setting off the search. It had a 4-day oxygen supply when it launched. Now it may have less than 1 day's worth of oxygen left. Significant warnings about the safety of the vessel were apparently issued during its development. Lost aboard the vessel are the CEO of the company leading the expedition, a British adventurer, 2 members of a Pakistani business family, and a Titanic expert. It's likely the diver on board the Titan has advised passengers to do anything possible to reduce breathing and metabolic levels, quote, to potentially extend that 96 hours, end quote. The submersible did have 7 backup systems to return to the surface, including sandbags and lead pipes that drop off, and an inflatable balloon. Now, if the submersible is below a couple hundred meters and is without power, the passengers are in complete darkness and without heat. The vessel is almost certainly too deep for human divers to get to it. The best chance to reach the submersible is said to be using a remotely operated robot on a fiber optic cable.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Street Roots correspondent Aurora Biggers. Her new article details the Magic Tavern stripper strike in Oregon and the dancers' efforts to become the second unionized club in the U.S. At 6, it's Earth Riot Radio, and at 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio. Then at 7, Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw. Tonight's weather will be sunny into the evening on this summer solstice with an overnight low of 50 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be hot and sunny with a high of 85 degrees. Today in history, in 1983, American whistleblower Edward Snowden was born. Snowden leaked classified information from the National Security Agency in 2013. The leak revealed multiple global surveillance programs and sparked a major debate about national security and individual privacy. The quote of the day is from Snowden, who said, quote, "Sometimes the scandal is not what law was broken, but what the law allows."
The Supreme Court ruled to uphold the Indian Child Welfare Act last week in a move that was a welcome surprise for Native tribes and activists. It's a decision that Native leaders are still taking time to process. Much of the last 6 months was spent preparing for the opposite verdict. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Alaska Native leaders continue to digest the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling last week on the Indian Child Welfare Act, which rejected efforts to overturn a law that's been in place for more than four decades. Valerie Davidson is an Alaska Native attorney who has dealt with ICWA for much of her career. She served as a commissioner for health and social services and helped negotiate a tribal compact that led to improved services for Alaska Native children in child custody cases. She's now president of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, which also works to protect the health and well-being of Native children. Davidson applauded the court's decision for many reasons, but mainly, she says, it helps keep decisions about child welfare closer to home.
Part of it is really an issue of practicality, for example. So if you have a child who is in a small village with an average population of 300 people, and there is no state agency physically there to be able to do that intervention, but the tribe is there and can intervene immediately, that's a much better outcome.
Davidson, who grew up in the Yupik communities of Bethel and Aniak, has firsthand knowledge about the challenges of providing services to children in remote areas. She says tribes can help within minutes to assist, where state social workers might have to travel by airplane from Anchorage, which can take hours, weeks, and sometimes months.
Tribes have had decades of proven track record of improving programs, really through incredible innovation. Those tribal partnerships are happening everywhere.
Davidson says had ICWA been overturned, it could have jeopardized programs that have been decades in the making. Gone Native, a series of animated digital shorts, is using comedy to help educate people about Indigenous life. Hannah Bissett with KNBA has more.
Gone Native has been in the works for the last 5 years. First debuting in film festivals, the inspiration for the short series comes from a surprising place. Joey Clift is a writer.
A Facebook post that a few friends of mine made a few years ago about the protest against the, at the time, unfortunately named Washington, D.C. NFL team's name. And somebody commented on the post saying something to the effect of, "Hey, I just got my DNA test in the mail and it says I'm 1/100th Indian. And personally, I think the team name is fine. So everybody just lay off."
Cliff's the creative writer behind the 5-episode short series. He says that after this internet encounter, he wanted to find quick, comedic, and educational material to show to the person, and most he could see were longer think pieces. In response to this lack of material, he created his own. He says the response to the shorts has been immense, with millions of views over various platforms.
It's so validating to see that something that I created didn't just like make people laugh, but like it's equipping like Native kids easy jokes that they can use to like diffuse what would otherwise a bummer, you know, racial microaggression situation.
Clift wants everyone who listens to the series to learn something new. According to a recent study from Illuminative, 87% of state history standards across the United States for the curriculum of K through 12 does not mention Native American history after the 1900s.
And I think that that lack of education is what has led to so many of these just like weird microaggressions against Native people that have made it into the mainstream, just because people like don't know any better.
The series has seen praise internet-wide, giving Indigenous people short comedic material to educate peers.
Hope you watch the series, but I also hope you go to GoneNative.tv and click around, read some of those links, and just get a little bit more educated about these issues so that I don't have to correct bosses when they call a meeting a powwow ever again.
I'm Hannah Bissett.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
This year, in New York City, the lithium batteries from e-scooters and e-bikes have caused over 100 fires and killed 13 people. Four of those deaths were yesterday in an e-bike store near Chinatown. The speed and impact of lithium battery fires makes them particularly perilous, especially when people live close together. For most of these vehicles, the batteries are removed to be charged, recharged, usually indoors. Lithium batteries, in commercial use since 1991, have a history of sparking fires in Dell notebook computers, Samsung smartphones, and hoverboards, leading to huge recalls. The batteries in e-bikes contain far more energy than in cell phones and, as a result, are more destructive in a fire. Electric cars and energy storage systems require far more energy and yet have fewer fires, as those industries are closely regulated and have to go through several layers of testing to show their products are safe. In September, New York will become the first city in the nation to ban the sale of e-bikes and other e-mobility devices that fail to meet recognized safety standards.
The U.S. Federal Trade Commission, or FTC, is suing Amazon for enrolling customers without their consent into its paid subscription program, Amazon Prime, and making it hard for them to cancel. Amazon made $9.6 billion from subscriptions in just the first 3 months of this year, a 17% jump from the same period last year. The FTC said Amazon used, quote, manipulative, coercive, or deceptive user interface designs known as dark patterns to trick consumers into enrolling in automatically renewing Prime subscriptions. Prime started in 2005 and has more than 200 million members worldwide. Members pay $139 a year or $14.99 a month for faster shipping and other perks like free delivery and the streaming service Prime Video. Lena Khan is the chair of the FTC. Khan said, quote, Amazon tricked and trapped people into recurring subscriptions without their consent, not only frustrating users, but also costing them significant money, end quote. Earlier this month, Amazon agreed to pay a $25 million civil penalty to settle allegations it violated a child privacy law by storing kids' voice and location data in its Alexa voice assistant.
Maine Senator Susan Collins is leading a bipartisan group of lawmakers to expand environmental literacy in a bill dubbed the No Child Left Inside Act. Supporters say increasing students' access to the great outdoors will improve their overall health and help build a critical mass of citizens working to combat climate change. Catherine Carley has the details.
Congressional lawmakers are considering a bill to help improve the environmental literacy of America's students. Dubbed the No Child Left Inside Act, the bill would authorize about $100 million for grants to help more teachers get their students learning outdoors. Maine Environmental Education Association Policy Director Amara Ifeji says increasing students' access to the natural world will help build the movement needed to tackle the most pressing environmental problems.
I think that's really the first step to environmental justice. It's just connection and building a relationship.
Ifeji says too often students from underprivileged communities lack access to the great outdoors, leading to poor physical and mental health outcomes. Research shows students are often better able to focus when learning in nature, and teachers report better student behavior and social interactions. States with updated environmental literacy plans would be eligible for the funding through the No Child Left Inside Act. That includes Maine, which increased its outdoor learning experiences during the pandemic. Ifeji says more than 100 lawmakers in Maine are currently co-sponsoring a bill to help school districts partner with residential outdoor learning facilities.
We have a ton in the state of Maine, and be able to host 3-day, 2-night residential outdoor learning experience for students to be able to learn about Maine's natural resources.
Ifeji says both pieces of legislation will help students cultivate habits that help the environment, including cutting down on single-use plastic or food waste, but will also help them turn any feelings of eco-anxiety or climate grief into climate hope. For Maine News Service, I'm Catherine Carley. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael knows what's greasing the wheels of our climate crisis.
I want to honor all life, and maybe not all multimillionaires are bad people, but the million plus spent on that journey down to the Titanic, as if that wreck itself is not an icon of technological arrogance, would feed how many for a week? Basic truth, the problem with resources isn't the amount, but the distribution. A non-nuclear aircraft carrier uses as much fuel in a week as a small town does in a year, while an F-16 jet uses 1/4 of that much in a single hour. The U.S. has sent F-16s to Ukraine. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia, defining sports washing, has bought out professional golf, probably the least green of any sport, wasting thousands of acres while employing tanker loads of chemicals to create an illusion of verdure. And what's that artificial turf in major stadiums in Oregon and the rest of the world made of? For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 21st, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories, tips, limericks, etc. at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Dan Raphael. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Suzanne Potter, and Catherine Carley. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Laura Miller. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Aurora Biggers, Street Roots correspondent, about her new article, Strippers on Strike, Magic Tavern Dancers Striking to be Second Unionized Club in U.S. Welcome, Aurora.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being with us today. So your new piece details the labor organizing effort at the Magic Tavern in Portland, as well as the history of unionization in the strip club industry. Let's rewind to before this organizing effort began and give people an idea. What were the conditions like at Magic Tavern that motivated the dancers to work to unionize?
Absolutely. Well, Magic Tavern opened back in November 2022, and pretty quickly after that, dancers say that they realized that there were a lot of significant security and safety issues in the club. Chiefly, workers were concerned that when the club opened, there weren't any cameras inside. And it's an industry standard to have cameras inside the club, so that was something that workers were immediately concerned about. There are now cameras inside the club currently, but they're not all in all the places dancers feel that they need to be. There was also a concern around security. The club, when it opened, had one security guard. That security guard, though, often also worked as the DJ or the cook. When talking to some of the dancers, you know, one said, how can you be protecting your girls when you're making a burger? So those are some of the main concerns that they had, as well as other behaviors from management that workers did not feel were appropriate in the workplace. But security concerns are definitely the main thing that they are trying to address through their current campaign.
Well, yeah, to that point, what are their demands and as a part of this unionization effort?
You know, when they went on strike, a few days before they actually decided to start working with the union, which is Actors Equity. And at that time, they were going on strike because they wanted to demand a few different things from the club, including an official contract with the club. They also wanted to have a dedicated booking manager, an appropriate amount of adequately trained security, and they also wanted some physical safety issues fixed. So when the club opened, the dancers also said that the flooring and the pole weren't properly installed, which is a massive physical safety issue, especially when you're working in 6 to 9 inch heels on a dance floor and, you know, doing athletics. That's something that's not very safe. They're also looking to have a more equitable environment for queer dancers and dancers of color, and we'll also be bringing up things like wages and scheduling as well.
So Magic Tavern, if their union drive succeeds, would become the second unionized strip club in the U.S., but what can you tell us about the other currently unionized club, Star Garden?
Star Garden unionized, I believe, last month, and before their campaign, before their election, they had about a 15-month campaign, and we're going to be, you know, as you said, the only unionized strip club in the United States. That was something that was very significant in the labor movement and for the workers. It's something that has been cited by workers in all industries as an inspiration, but in particular for the Magic Tavern dancers as an inspiration, because they were able to see that this sort of campaign in this industry is something that is possible, as Star Garden workers proved. But like you said, they are currently the only unionized strip club in the U.S., making it something that's fairly novel because of some of the barriers that there are to organizing in this particular industry.
Now, Star Garden isn't actually the first ever unionized club, though. That was the Lusty Lady in San Francisco, and you talked a little bit about that history in your article as well. What motivated their organizing drive, and how did they find success?
Yeah, so the Lusty Lady dancers in San Francisco, like you said, back in the 90s, they also decided to launch a campaign and went on strike for some of the same concerns that Star Garden and Magic Tavern workers have. So these dancers cited, you know, that there wasn't a lot of security. There were customers that were taking photos inside the club, even though that was against rules and security wasn't necessarily doing anything about it. They also had issues with the wages that they were being paid.